Welcome to Battleground Wisconsin. This is Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Our usual host and my partner, Matt Brusky, he's not with us this week. He'll be back next week, but I'm not flying solo. We have a noted national expert on the development of the right-wing conspiracy to, broadly speaking, end democracy, but it has a lot more implications than that. To join us, and given that Wisconsin is at the center of who will be the next president, to understand the stakes better and the long-term nature of this conspiracy. So we're pleased to have Ann Nelson. She's an award-winning journalist, author of a very well-regarded book on the right called Shadow Network. Ann is a research scholar at Columbia University, and she has written at some of the best analysis of Project 2025, the becoming increasingly well-known Heritage Foundation effort to lay out the agenda for the next Trump administration, but actually for any GOP president. So, Ann, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So we're going to get to Project 2025, which most of our listeners probably have heard of. It's made it to cable news and the like, at least a little bit. But I thought, since we have an expert on the whole trajectory of the far right and its takeover of the GOP and what it is trying to accomplish, to start out with the origins of this and why this is the end of a strategy in many ways. It did not just come out of the mind of Donald Trump, though he's a critical actor in it now. It was developed well before Trump was on the political scene. So, Ann, I'm wondering, you in your book, Shadow Network, you do a really good job of talking about a shadowy entity called the Council for National Policy and how that was in many ways the place that coordinated across the various sectors of the right, the religious evangelical right, ultimately the gun movement, the school voucher movement, and the anti-climate movement, i.e. from extractive industries and other sectors of the right. And so maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about, even though this is not a, this is not something that's thrown out the way ALEC is and some of the other parts of the right-wing infrastructure that get a lot of attention, a little more about this entity and why it's played a critical role in creating kind of a unified right-wing position that's put them in position to try to seize power.
Well, it's interesting that you mention ALEC, because the director of ALEC is a member of the Council for National Policy, as well as the head of the State Policy Network and the Heritage Foundation. So what you have is a coordinating organization, an umbrella organization, the Council for National Policy, that has various core organizations as members that actually implement their strategies. And what makes them so influential is that they bring together donors. And this, one of the major active donors these days is the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, but also the DeVos family from Michigan. And then a lot of cross intersecting funding from the Koch network, Charles Koch as the last brother standing, along with activist organizations. Right now, Turning Point USA is quite prominent with them. The Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America anti-abortion group is quite active. And then finally, as I say in the subtitle of my book, media. And this is extremely important, because I, like you, I'm a Midwesterner, and the role of radio has been extremely important in their movement. So one of their core organizations is Salem Media, which has thousands of radio stations across the country, as well as other partners like the American Family Radio in Mississippi and Bot Radio, which are fundamentalist, combined with right-wing talk radio stations. And these thousands of stations have pumped out right-wing propaganda lightly dressed as news and information, and reach audiences that are increasingly neglected by other professional journalism outlets. And they've also proliferated in terms of their social media. So this is a networked effect. And so you get a very kind of unified corporate structure where you have people setting the strategy, doing the branding, doing the framing, paying for research and development, and then having their own dedicated media system to pump it out to specific voter blocks. And I can say that Wisconsin has been among their targets.
So that's extremely helpful because this, and I want to dig into the radio in a second as part of the communication strategy, but we'll dig into the other strands. Since I interact, as we're a statewide organizing group with philanthropy on the left, and also and we have far less money than the right does, but the fact of the matter is you often have, oh, we need media. Why doesn't someone invest in radio? Or we need to organize voter turnout among Black folks in big cities. So we're going to fund groups to do that. It seems much more piecemeal and almost buffet that what they did is they came up with an integrated strategy where they thought about all the elements they needed to gain power and there achieve the agenda. And you point out in your book that that's in sharp contrast to what they faced in the Democratic Party or the organized left that is funded by institutional funders like major liberal foundations.
Absolutely. And I talk about a different culture between the two parties. We traditionally, the Republicans have been the culture of business. And I think that now this new MAGA Republican Party that's taken over the rest of it is even more the party of big business and corporations. It's not the kind of Truman era Chamber of Commerce guys with a drugstore on the main street anymore. It's the Koch brothers, it's the DeVos Amway, it's these major corporations. And what you've lost in the Republican Party is that when you had the mom and pop drugstore on the main street, they had an investment in their community, right? They knew their customers. And if they failed their customers, they faced social stigma. So when you have something as massive as Koch Industries or Amway, there's no connection to their clientele. There's no sense of responsibility or civic engagement. It just becomes an environment of pure corporate profit. And that's how they run their operation. Now, the Democrats, to a large extent, are a party of run by lawyers and journalists and policy analysts, and they often run it like a debating society, right? They're very good at arguing with each other, which is wonderful in terms of the marketplace of ideas. But you often have organizations that are good organizations that need to grow, and you don't have long-term investment in them. They don't get the chance to go on the nursery slopes and learn through experience. Whereas these organizations connected to the Council for National Policy have had constant funding over 40 years. And comparing the two models, let me just say that one works better.
And they have the ability to reach a consensus within each issuary and across them. So I get from our members, activists, the Democratic Party needs to like there's any kind of decision-making body of the Democratic Party. There actually isn't. I was on the platform committee for Bernie Sanders in 2016, which was hotly contested with the more conventional part of the party, and that was a flat-out debate and negotiation. There was nothing pre-cooked about it, and I got the Hillary forces to accept the platform of amendment on health care. They moved. I mean, that is not you're not going to go and change the gun policy of the right
Yeah.
in an open platform committee meeting of the RNC where someone who isn't even nationally prominent is in the middle of the debate. That's just not the way they're structured. And so you talked about media. I want to dig into each part of their strategy. And you tell the story in Shadow Network of how you had a change in conventional media. We used to have big broadcast networks, papers, newspapers in every major market that were the main source of information, and how the corporate kind of takeover of a lot of the family operations, that actually led to a corporate takeover. In other words, it became they sold off, and you explain why. So you have a decay of the old conventional newspapers and what the role of broadcast is. And of course, they moved a lot of reforms like the Reagan stuff on the Fairness Doctrine, the Telecommunications Act under Clinton, et cetera, to make it possible for them to come in and consolidate media and dominate, starting with radio, the airwaves, but a whole lot of other things. And there is no Democratic Party or further left progressives integrated strategy on that with resources behind it. And the news media is very different function. Cable news has different incentives and doesn't balance. So I know I've put a lot on your plate. Don't feel like I have to answer all of that, but give the audience a sense of the basics of their long term. It's not just sudden communication strategy to what it does is it changes the conventional wisdom of everyone that's within their audiences. And you also talk about, and this is probably the next thing we can go to, the role of evangelical Christian media as the core basis for the broader right-wing media that's been built.
So let's back up a bit. So I grew up in Nebraska and Oklahoma in the 60s and 70s. And this was a period where every middle-sized and even small towns had at least one newspaper. And the radio stations and the television stations tended to work off the news of the newspapers. People who went to journalism school or who were learned in the newsroom tended to be faithful to the idea of factual reporting, right? And they were answerable if they got something wrong. So this is a whole culture of news. The other part of it that is so important is the role of the wire services. So Associated Press had member newspapers all across the country who sent news in from these small and medium-sized towns and received news from the home office that was edited and redistributed.
And the
So
UPI,
you,
they had the UPI. I'm old enough to
the
remember
UPI as
UPI
well,
and
the New York
UPI
Times.
reporters at the state capitol here in Wisconsin.
Yes, when UPI was a news organization, which now it is less so. So you had this consensus of the concept of fact, right? Now, of course, over this period, you had huge disagreements about the Vietnam War. But when facts about a battle or a peace conference went out, people were arguing more or less from the same page. They weren't arguing, totally different facts that had nothing to say to each other.
And you have a great
So,
quote, Anne, about Walter Cronkite and the Vietnam War in your book.
yeah, well, I had the privilege of knowing the great man, and he was incredibly serious about news and the importance of serving the American public with factual reporting. That was his religion. And so what you had, first of all, was this proliferation of fundamentalist radio stations that happened in the 30s and 40s, but they tended to be religious content. But then around 2000, you have a double whammy hitting American professional journalism. First of all, the internet, which blew up the revenues of advertising, which is what they depended on. Second of all, the economic crisis of 2008, which further crippled them. And then you had this massive die-off of newspapers across the country, but especially in the middle of the country. I call it a colony collapse, where you lose a third of the newspapers, you lose half of the professional journalists. And as we know, nature abhors a vacuum. What springs up in these rural communities and these lightly populated areas that can't sustain a metropolitan newspaper are these exploitative organizations that pump out content that is supported by payment, not by the audience. Now, people here, I live in New York City now, and they say, oh, but there's NPR. Well, NPR does not have the coverage of the United States that would make it penetrating the entire country, especially in rural areas. You have a college station, that's great. Their signal strength may not be very big. They may not have many relay stations in a lot of these states. Well, and I will also say, frankly, that a lot of the content tends to be more urban, right? I mean, when I was growing up in Nebraska, the farm report was on at 6 a.m., and there was content on television that spoke to that community, and NPR has a hard time doing that. You have an experiment in Wisconsin, Civic Radio, which has some stations, and that's very promising. From what I know of it, it is more community oriented.
I'm on one of their shows for an hour every week, the Earl Ingram show. So yeah, very familiar with
Excellent.
that. Yeah.
Well, so we need 50 civic medias in 50 states. Well, maybe we need 100 civic medias in 50 states. It's a great model, but I've been really disappointed not to see other people pick it up and run with it in other areas, because it's very what people in major cities like New York don't understand is that in a lot of America, people spend time in cars. And when they're in cars, they turn the radio on. Radio is not a medium of the past.
Well,
And radio has often also provided a platform for all of these social media platforms that have spun off, and these online so-called news sites like Breitbart and so on, that have been an additional part of the problem.
and it wasn't a part of a strategy of something like the Council for National Policy. That is, one radio host decided to create it, and then he ended up selling eventually to someone with more money who could fund its build out. But it's just a radio strategy in Wisconsin, which is great and useful to us, but it wasn't part of some sort of strategy to build out national, progressive, or democratic communication. I think that's the
Well,
big.
and there's also a values problem, because I think people on the Democratic side admirably want to present professional journalism, which means covering both sides, which means critical reporting. And these outlets on the right do not, I mean, they do not host Democratic candidates. I mean, I've watched hundreds of hours, and I have not seen a single Democratic spokesperson presenting or representing their policy. It's and when you have entirely one-sided content, another name for that is propaganda.
Right, and NPR has had Washington correspondents, like Capitol correspondents, that are quite conservative, actually. They're offering, and then they have also some very progressive ones in other parts of the station. So Mara Liasson was not giving a progressive perspective at all of Capitol news. If anything, in my opinion, it was tilted the other side. But that's because, but she had journalistic standards. They were working within a journalistic framework, as you said.
Well,
Can
they also give a lot of airing to Republican leaders in
Yes.
Congress, and a respectful hearing, give them plenty of airtime. This is not done, period, on the other side.
Right.
So we're really comparing, apples and oranges here.
So I know we want to get to Project 25, but let's touch on some of the major other elements of this. You spent a lot of time in Shadow Network talking about the change in the evangelical church. Right, evangelist has now become a synonym for Trump, actually, but it never was before. And how entrepreneurs like Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, many others built up not only this media but this connection to Republican politics and used the tax code to get away with it, which is a critical part of your book, that the exploitation of the tax code by this right by this by the right in order to build this infrastructure.
Well, I'll push back a little bit there, because I don't see evangelical as a synonym for the right. You did have some televangelists of the past. My home state of Oklahoma was the birthplace of some of these operations, like Billy James
Oh, I
Hargis
agree with
and
you
so on.
historically, but Tim Alberta's book, recent book, actually says now that church, some churches that are not Trump are thinking of removing the name from their official title to become a synonym. I agree that's a complete distortion of the historic meaning evangelical.
Yeah, and maybe some churches, but I personally know many people who consider themselves evangelical Christians and have no time for MAGA politics. And you've got the evangelical left, which would include Reverend Barber and Jonathan Wilson Hargrove. And you've also got an evangelical center of people who feel buffeted by these political headwinds. And sometimes stigmatized by the way the national press is handling terms like Christian and evangelical.
Yeah, what Alberta's book is about, the purging of parishioners and any moderate theologians or educators. But maybe the better way historically to describe this is just the Christian right. But can you talk a little bit about how critical the Christian right was, taking your point on evangelical, in building the infrastructure that has led to Project 2025?
Sure. A lot of historians go back to the civil rights era, and that was the period when the Internal Revenue Service and the federal government decided that segregated academies that reacted to integrated public schools would no longer receive tax exemptions. So if they wanted tax exemptions from federal taxes, they had to be integrated. And a group of televangelists, primarily, who had set up schools like this to avoid integration, got together and decided they needed a kind of larger political framework to fight their corner. You had Pat Robertson, you had Jerry Falwell, Bob Jones was involved, and it was really a pushback against school integration. They formed the Council for National Policy in 1981. They brought in donors from the fossil fuels industry, many of them from Texas, and they started developing a long-term strategy. And as I said, that has been their superpower. It wasn't about winning the next election. It was about building infrastructures that would take them 40 years into the future, which is where we are now. And when you go from their origins, they started out writing these prescriptions for Republican administrations 40 years ago and introduced them periodically with varying success. So the MAGA plan, Project 2025, is just the latest of a series of these plans that kind of brings together not just the ideas of the past, like closed down Head Start, closed down public broadcasting, both PBS and NPR, closed down, like everything that would, many things that some of us believe are public services, but which are to have some taxpayer support. So these perennials are in this project, but they're also much more audacious, because they have the benefit of former members of the Trump administration. And these are people who've been inside the federal government, know what the levers are, and have a much clearer idea about how to get immediate results and how to overcome bureaucratic and legal obstacles.
So that a lot of them got training in the first Trump 1.0 administration.
That's right.
If they didn't have it already, they gained even more experience on what they were not able to do the first time, and then come back with plans on how we're going to do it the second time. And I want to get to the what their 700-page plan and what's in it, because you've delved into that
900.
900. I apologize, I understated its length. And we can talk about the elements that you lay out in your book are familiar to people. The fossil fuel industry, extractive industries, right to life, pro-school vouchers, the gun movement, others. So those all come up in some way in the 900 pages, I'm sure. So then we can delve into some of the origins of this. I think in your Washington Spectator article on this project, you make a really good point that this is a plan for the next Republican administration. It's not Trump dependent, though Trump may be, we can argue this, more or less effective in doing it, and may, or more likely to do it fully. But you also point out of the evangelical, I mean, not the evangelical, the Christian right movement, they are conscious of the move to a secular society and how, in a way, they have to lock in minority rule now in order to maintain their influence. And so there really is a deadline for them in terms of demographics and the transition of this society. And you're seeing that paralleled in the Republican Party now. They have the same concern. They need to lock in a system where they can rule and have power. And they're afraid that their version of conservatism, they won't be able to. But I want to start, because it's the one with these all have big consequences, but the biggest, that is climate change, which is the biggest threat to human life in human history. I mean, it's that bad. That Project 2025 just is what you've outlined in the Washington Spectator article is terrifying on climate. And of course, extractive industries and billionaires have at the center of this infrastructure building since the beginning. So if you could say a little bit about what they have planned for us, my reading of this is we're guaranteeing runaway climate change if this country adopts this agenda.
Yeah, I mean, and I think even beyond that, you've had the Biden administration making efforts to address climate through international agreements and various energy initiatives. And obviously, they've had great obstacles presented by Congress, but they've pushed forward anyway. And if you look at the last few administrations, you can see it's a tug of war, where the Democrats try to have a climate policy that's in line with other industrialized nations. And then as soon as you elect a Republican, they try to roll them all back. So this is the rollback of all rollbacks. This is withdrawing from the Paris Accords. This is opening up every possibility of drilling in every venue. I mean, I was shocked. They even want to remove energy ratings from air conditioners,
Yes.
right? Which, as a consumer, those ratings save me money, but they would rather burn more fuel than save the consumers, some pennies when they're running their devices. So
They want to
it's
block the
really.
renewable energy transition, even if it's more economical, because that's the cheapest form of energy right now, is wind and solar.
Absolutely. I mean, it's I would I know it sounds onerous to your audience to read 900 pages. They don't have to read them all at once, but people who care about the environment and the catastrophes that could be in store for us, just go to the chapter. Well, okay, start with my Washington Spectator piece, which is like Cliff Notes. I pulled out some of the more startling passages and quote them verbatim, and then interpret how they would be applied. So it's less onerous than reading the original, I think. And it's just a wraparound 360 approach to dismantling all climate policy. And then to add insult to injury, reversing, the Endangered Species Act and reversing measures that are designed to promote clean air and clean water. It's really just saying that corporate profit rides roughshod over every aspect of American life.
Given our little tour, we're doing a quick house tour, a museum tour, and you did some of this in the Washington Spectator. We'll provide this link in our Battleground Wisconsin website and email to Ann's article. But going across the sectors, and feel free to talk about the origin of how they got to this, if it's useful. What would you call out to our audience? Some of the other, I called out climate, other scary elements of this, and in different elements of policy.
Well, I singled out the bundle of public health issues. I was shocked to see that they wanted to withdraw the ability of CDC officials, the Centers for Disease Control, to recommend vaccinations for school children. I'm the mother of two, and I'm aware that right now we have measles outbreaks in 17 states because of vaccine hesitancy. And a lot of that has been powered by the anti-COVID vaccine movement that was fueled by the same movement. I have a piece in the Washington Spectator about how that happened. And the idea that you are going to have Americans, measles has a fatality rate among children of 1 or 2 per thousand, right? Those are absolutely unnecessary deaths of children. Other children will have lasting health issues as a result of this. And then that opens the door if you go further into the vaccine hesitancy world, where we could have a resurgence of polio in this country. And I was not old enough to experience a lot of people of my contemporaries with polio, but I knew people who had it. And the idea that you have a resurgence of polio is criminal. It's just criminal. Vaccines are this scientific miracle that has been given to us. And if they're going to inflict this on our population, it is not acceptable. I'll go on. They also have a section that calls for the banning of certain language from all federal documents, bills, laws, regulations. One of the terms is gender. Another is gender identity. Another, for God's sake, is reproductive health, right? I'm sorry, as a woman, reproductive health includes uterine cancer, doesn't it? It includes ectopic pregnancies. So you don't have any federal language that can talk about reproductive health. Some of the Project 2025 content is disturbing, and other elements are basically insane. So you go on from that to this idea of a retroactive concept of the American family, where they state that every child has the right to be raised by their biological father and mother. What do we do with that? Are they going to outlaw adoption? I mean, certainly they plan to outlaw marriage equality and any possibility of children being raised by two parents of the same sex. How many thousands does that affect? The real problem with this document is that it's a blueprint for action. It's not just this kind of theoretical pie in the sky discussion. It's saying this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. These are the people we are currently recruiting and training to implement these measures once we purge tens of thousands of civil servants from the federal government
That's the
in the
other thing.
first days.
It'll all be loyalists appointed. It's a new ideological patronage system for all government.
Well, or MAGA militants,
Right.
indeed. And they that the recruiting is already going on along with the training. So this is a plan that has been set in motion, and it's one step on the way to the elections.
So, and what's amazing is it was easy for a long time to write off their discourse, like what they said on the radio, right? And saying, well, this is what they say to get power. They're not really serious. It's like the non-fact-based assertions that they're actually serious about implementing a lot of them. That's the shocking thing, which is shocking to anyone who's on the other side, progressives or mainline Democrats. Let me ask you about in the 900 pages, what is the structure of American democracy if they're able to put this plan and majority rule or one person, one vote?
Well, what one thing that it does systematically is concentrate powers in the White House. So, one thing that they do is change the order of command for the FBI and put it more directly under White House control so that it becomes kind of a paramilitary arm of a Republican president. And I should add that even if you have a Republican president and Congress elected in November, there are still checks and balances in the American system that would not allow all of the elements of Project 2025 to be implemented in the short term and perhaps ever. I mean, some of them are so sweeping, like the child's right to both biological parents. I mean, my brain is not big enough to see how you would implement that in real terms in American society, right? Some of it is grandstanding, and some of it is really granular. And how? So, for example, a lot of it has to do with preparing the way to a permanent hold on power. So
Right.
it talks about closing down cybersecurity operations, especially before elections. Why would you want to do that? It talks about closing down FBI cybersecurity operations. So we already know that the Russians, as well as the Chinese and the Iranians, have been conducting a great deal of mischief online in terms of trying to tilt the balance in the favor of the Republicans. AP just had a story about how the Russians have been pumping out media in Latin America promoting the immigration crisis with a great deal of success, I might add, because you've got this push in terms of Latin American or immigration over the southern border, and you've got the corresponding panic that is being pumped out in terms of the right-wing media. So, cybersecurity is more important than ever. And of course, that's exactly what they want to disband. And as I often say, the internet is the porous frontier of the United States, and we are being invaded.
So they won't be able necessarily to do everything, but the checks and balances are less than they used to be. They have a Trump-packed U.S. Supreme Court and judges all over the place. If the White House grabs more power, which is a different constitutional arrangement, actually, they can implement. But there are some limits. Some of this stuff is pie in the sky. Some of it is deadly serious. What we talk about on Battleground Wisconsin is the importance of everyone. Yeah, doing their part to win an election. It seems like you who've been studying this for a long time, Anne, and are award-winning journalist and researcher and lecturer at Columbia, that you're saying that we should take what they've written down here deadly seriously, and that's the stakes in 2024 and beyond. It may not just be winning one election, because this is a 50-plus year development to get to this point where they have a shot to implement at least part of this of Project 2025.
Yeah, and in my Washington Spectator piece, I really tried to break it down among different categories in terms of what was a more serious threat and what was aspirational. But I must say that, even if they can't reverse trans policy, for example, overnight, the ability for an individual to choose to change their sex, they can create an atmosphere that is so toxic that it might as well be a legal implementation, because then their adherents and their militants take matters into their own hands. And you see that happening in different parts of the United States.
Yeah, and it's like we've been sleepwalking a bit, where people are very well versed in parts of the conspiracy, like pro-life, like vouchers, like people who are involved in that fight. But seeing the scale of it, how re well resourced it is, how they've produced a base for it, and how they have the ideal, in many ways, candidate who can potentially win and would allow them to do this in Donald Trump, understanding he comes with downsides too. He could ultimately, because of his downsides, undermine some of this. But it seems like we need to win this election, but then beyond this election, all those that are in favor of the original, the history, the constitutional traditions of this country and the notion of a large-scale multiracial democracy need to plan in a much more integrated way to challenge what has been built on the other side.
So I think it's really instructive to look at the fact that this document has 100 supporting organizations, and many of them are partners at the Council for National Policy, as it happens. Many say about, perhaps around half are organizations that get money from the Koch network. So when they talk about anti-environmental, anti-climate policy approaches, the Kochs and the fossil fuel industries are pushing that with millions and millions of dollars. Another major donor network behind these organizations is Leonard Leo, who received 1.6 billion with a B dollars to promote the right-wing judiciary. And so a lot of the so-called social warfare organizations are on the payroll from them. So you've got a couple of mega donors who are pushing their agenda. And one thing that I think has been confusing to the public is that people tend to concentrate on either the social elements, the anti-LGBT, the anti-abortion elements, or climate, and not seeing how the donor bases are totally interwoven. I've done a lot of research. I don't think any of the Kochs give a toss about religion. So if you just call it a Christian nationalist movement, you're
Right.
only half right. As I say frequently, the only thing I can find the Kochs worshiping is mammon. And on the other side, it's really painful for me to see people who are evangelical and fundamentalist Christians being pulled into this movement to the detriment of themselves and their communities and their children, right? So they're basically voting to pollute their water supplies. They're voting to destroy their public school systems. They're voting not to have public health to keep themselves and their children healthy. And it's just painful to watch. But as somebody who studied media systems for decades of my career, I can see how powerful the media is in pulling people into these movements and the terrible price that we're paying.
That's very instructive. And the coalition element of what they're doing, not each individual in it cares about every part of it, that it's a power strategy. And they know that the various other elements helpful for them doing what they want to do, right? And so there's this coalition that we don't see on the other side. It's why a minority can potentially, and this is true in world history, how a minority seizes power, that it is more effective and more integrated and can win the battles necessary. So, yeah, go ahead,
So
Andrew.
I would
Before
love
Derek
to see
closed, go ahead.
everybody who is interested in covering this election to at least look at my synopsis of Project 2025, if not the whole 900 pages. Look at the synopsis. This is what is on the ballot in November. And what the major media and what the Republican media system wants you to believe is that the election in November is between two elderly white men. What we're actually facing in November is voting for the life under Project 2025 with all of its draconian damaging elements, or a very imperfect democracy where you have some chance to address the problems and you're going to fail, but at least you can get up in the morning and try again. So it's a vote not necessarily for Democrats, but for democracy with a little d, which is the best thing that this country has ever invented.
That's very well said, Anne, because, and we're on the progressive side of the spectrum. There are things we're pleased with the Biden administration around, like his advances on climate. There are places where he needs to evolve a lot more. But if he wins, there's a chance to do these things in the long term. It's a question of whether, not whether it's perfect, but whether or not there's any ability to have ongoing democracy where we can play a role. And what we focus on, that politics is not a spectator sport, it's a participatory sport. And so we're encouraging people to volunteer, to take action, to talk to their neighbors and friends in effective deep canvas operations, or if they're elected leaders, do everything they can, because your votes count more than everyone else's because of the structural inequality created in the original Constitution. That is, in the Electoral College, only a handful of states decide the outcome, and Wisconsin is one of them. So I think this has been extremely helpful, Anne, to have you give us this guided tour. We'll provide links both to your Washington Spectator article, which can bring you to the whole 900 pages if you're interested, and to Shadow Network, your excellent book on the whole history of this right-wing infrastructure and what's behind it and how they're all related to each other and interrelated. But it's just been fantastic. A great treat to have you take us on this tour, Anne.
Oh, great. Thank you. And I guess I'm supposed to say regards to the cheese heads.
I think Wisconsin's the kind of state where they own the cheese head, that it's not like it's not
Not
offensive.
what you are, you have them. Okay. Well, I'll have
We're
to
the
come back
cheddar
and
cheese head, yeah.
okay. Well, good. I loved the beer and the brats when I went the last time.
Oh, good. And the beer is getting better and better with craft. Every small city or even larger town has a craft brewery these days. My neighborhood in Milwaukee has eight of them and counting, if they keep being started. And then, of course, yes, there's always the brats.
Well, I
So
hope to make it back before too long.
that'd be awesome. Hopefully, we won't have some election crisis where you're here to cover, the succession battle. Who knows? So thank you very much, Anne. It's been great. Well, thank you for listening to Battleground Wisconsin. We'll be back next week with our regular panel and the breaking news of the day. So thank you, and have a great week.